Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, week one in the trial of Derek Chauvin. Emotions ran high in a Minneapolis courtroom as the prosecution made its case against the former police officer charged with killing George Floyd. Witnesses to last May's violence, which unleashed a wave of protests across the country, relived the horror of watching Chauvin pin Floyd's neck to the ground and the guilt of having not been able to intervene. The defense plans to build their case around Floyd's drug use, claiming an overdose killed him. To learn more about what happened this week and just how high the stakes are in this case, I turn to Paul Butler, professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center and author of Chokehold, Policing Black Men. I spoke with him Friday morning. Paul, tell us your reactions to the first week of the trial of Derek Chauvin.
The prosecution has put on a very strong case. The star witness is that tragic videotape of Mr. Floyd literally narrating his own death. And I think that it's difficult for the defense to overcome. I want to talk about emotion, but this is a criminal case. This is not about the national reckoning on race or police accountability. It's about the elements of second-degree murder and third-degree murder and manslaughter, which are the crimes that former Officer Chauvin is charged with. And what that videotape reveals is the excessive force and the reckless mind state by Officer Chauvin that's required for those convictions.
It has been such an emotional first week, so hard to watch, and I'm sure so difficult for those witnesses. Has the prosecution thus far achieved what it needed to do?
I think so. We always have to remember, as the judge will caution the jury, that we are only hearing one side of the case, and that Mr. Chauvin is innocent until proven guilty. And in fact, he doesn't even have to mount a defense. In our criminal legal system, it's the state that has the heavy burden of proof. We do know what the defense will be, which is that Officer Chauvin literally did not kill George Floyd, that Mr. Floyd died of a drug overdose and his pre-existing health conditions. They will also assert that the force that the officer used was reasonable because Mr. Floyd was resisting arrest. And while the whole world has seen that videotape, the most important part for the prosecution is the last 2 minutes. Diane, at that point, Officer Chauvin is informed that Mr. Floyd has no pulse. And Officer Chauvin continues to press his knee against Mr. Floyd's neck for another 2 minutes. Yesterday, we heard testimony from Chauvin's supervisor that when a suspect is complying, when he's not resisting, the force must stop. And obviously a person who is handcuffed, face down on the ground, being restrained by three police officers, is complying. So again, it's hard to make the case that the force was reasonable.
And what about the use of the videotape to recreate the day's events? Do you think that that has been useful not only for the jury and the judge, but also for the American public to see, because CNN has broadcast the entire proceedings?
Got to shout out MSNBC, where I'm a legal analyst, and MSNBC is also showing the trial. And I was on live watching while they showed the video of Mr. Floyd in the store where he left and went to his car to have the fatal encounter with Mr. Chauvin. And of course, Diane, a lot of us had seen the tragic video of Mr. Floyd's death, but I do think it was both important for the jurors and, in a sense, cathartic for the world to see a video of Mr. Floyd alive. At that store, he was waiting to get his telephone fixed, and he was joking around. He had a conversation about football versus baseball. He was a baseball guy. The store clerk testified that he was a little off. He was high, is what the clerk speculated. And of course, we know the government has acknowledged that, like many Americans, Mr. Floyd struggled with an opiate addiction. But we didn't see the wild dope fiend that the defense had projected in its opening statement. We saw somebody who was coherent, in control, and full of life.
And yet we are seeing conservative columnists peddling the lie that George Floyd died from fentanyl overdose. And that was on Facebook, finally flagged by Facebook as false information. But nevertheless, it remains on that platform. So those who are hoping that Mr. Chauvin is found not guilty, because all it takes, of course, is one juror to say that. Is conservative America going to believe that that's actually how he died?
Diane, you know, in this business, we get a lot of email. We get a lot of stuff on social media. Do you even read that stuff? It's hard, isn't it? So, man, the comments that I get after writing something about the case for the Washington Post or being on air, those are tough to read. To be clear, lots of support and lots of important critiques, because Lord knows I'll say some things that aren't right, but the hate from the people who think they're supporting the police. But this is a case in which, if you support the police, you want this bad apple, or I should say rotten apple cop, out of the business, because he's undermining the good work of so many officers. And so, yes, I hear a lot that George Floyd was this and George Floyd was that, including that he died of a drug overdose. And again, if you're an accused person in our criminal legal system, you get to tell the jury whatever you want to make your defense. Because as you acknowledge, Diane, all it takes is one juror to find reasonable doubt in the case. And if there's not a unanimous jury, then there is a hung jury, which means it's a mistrial. And Mr. Chauvin would consider a mistrial a victory in a case like this, where the evidence I submit is overwhelming. But I have some concerns about some things that the judge has done in this trial. I think, though, that he presided over a jury selection process that should be a model for other judges. It's a very diverse jury. It's diverse in terms of age and genders and race. About half of the jurors are people of color, which actually makes the jury more diverse than the city where the trial is taking place. And that's a good thing for the prosecution. It's also a good thing for the country, because I think whatever verdict is issued will have a legitimacy that it wouldn't if there were just one or two people of color, or worse yet, no people of color. The fact that there are four black people, two mixed race people, seven of the jurors are under the age of 40. All of that makes this jury look more like America. And I think gives me confidence that that jury will evaluate the evidence, just like the judge tells them to, based only on what they've heard in court and nothing else.
First of all, forgive me for omitting MSNBC, which is also carrying the full court proceedings live. But I'd like to go back to a point you made. You said you had some issues with some of the judgments the judge himself has made. Give us an example and how serious you believe those judgments are.
Well, one small thing just to demonstrate how the judge is kind of micromanaging the case. The judge will not allow the parties to refer to Mr. Floyd as a victim. And they will not allow the parties to refer to former Officer Chauvin as the accused person. And just in terms of the law, that's what they are. But, you know, that's not a big deal. What's a much larger deal is that last week, the judge says that he will now allow evidence of a previous arrest of Mr. Floyd to be seen by the jury. So the jury is going to be allowed to see videotape evidence of an arrest the year before where the officers confront Mr. Floyd in an automobile. Almost immediately, they have their guns out pointed at him. They force him out of the car and they put him in handcuffs. And apparently, there's evidence in this video that Mr. Floyd, when he knew he was going to be arrested, he consumed a pill. He took drugs. And the judge will also allow a paramedic to testify that Mr. Floyd told her that he had been on drugs that morning and that he'd taken seven pills that morning. And then when the officer was about to take him in, he took another pill, and the effect on that day was that his blood pressure was racing, and the paramedic said, you need to go to the hospital. He went to the hospital, not to jail, and we don't even know what he was arrested for because there were no charges. So the defense is going to say, and that's just what he did with Mr. Chauvin, except this time when he took the drugs, he died. And it's not relevant to this case, Diane. This case is about what killed Mr. Floyd. Was it the actions of the officer or was it an OD? And it's about whether the force that Officer Chauvin used was reasonable. And so what happened in an arrest the year before has no bearing on either of those, but it does have the potential to inflame the jury, to turn the jury against Mr. Floyd based on what they might see as his character and having nothing to do with the case. And the judge will appropriately caution the jury, but it's hard for the human brain to use information for one purpose but not another purpose. The judge, understanding this, for the last year pretty much has said that that evidence can't come in. And all of a sudden, week ago, he changed his mind.
So you wrote that George Floyd is not a perfect victim, but that that shouldn't matter. Do you think it will matter to the jury?
The prosecution knew that this could be an issue. And one of the good things that the judge did was to give both sides a lot of space to learn about the people who would be the jurors in this case. So even before they reported for jury duty to see if they would be selected to to be on this jury, they had to fill out a 14-page questionnaire, all kinds of questions. What do you know about the case? Where do you watch the news? What do you think about Black Lives Matter? What do you think about Blue Lives Matter? And then, when prospective jurors showed up at the courthouse, they were asked a series of questions by both the defense and the prosecution, including, how do you feel about people who suffer from drug addiction? And if someone who suffered from addiction was the victim of a crime, would you hold their addiction against them? And most of the people who ended up on the jury correctly said, if you're somebody who has a problem with drugs, you could still be the victim of a crime. And if you're somebody who suffers from addiction, that does not give another person the right to kill you. And so, based on what the jurors have said in order to get seated, I'm hoping that they can maintain that objectivity and not be made to have different, inappropriate ideas about Mr. Floyd based on his struggle. Again, a struggle that millions of Americans share. Diane, the testimony of Mr. Floyd's partner, his girlfriend, where she just put a face on addiction in a way that I haven't seen. She said that both she and Mr. Floyd had started out, like so many people, having such pain from an injury that they needed strong painkillers. And you know the story. From that medication that was so necessary and so important to an addiction that they just couldn't control.
So what about the autopsy? What did that tell us?
It told us that the cause of Mr. Floyd's death was homicide, which in that context is a medical term, not a legal term. It means that Mr. Floyd's death was caused by at least one human being other than Mr. Floyd. It's not a criminal determination, but it's certainly helpful to the prosecution. Because for the jury to think that Mr. Floyd just happened to have a heart attack or happened to OD while Officer Chauvin's knee was on his neck for over 9 minutes, that strains credulity, right? So there's going to be a battle of medical experts and toxicology reports, but at the end of the day, the judge will instruct the jury that they should use their common sense when they evaluate the evidence in this case. And again, I think the common sense is on the side of the prosecution.
A quick break. When we come back, the rest of my conversation with Paul Butler.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Paul Butler. He's Albert Brick Professor in Law at Georgetown University Law Center, MSNBC legal analyst, and author of Chokehold, Policing Black Men. So we don't know the list of witnesses that the prosecution is going to bring on, but I would assume that the medical examiner who made that declaration of homicide would be one of those witnesses.
That's right. And the prosecution doesn't have to prove that Mr. Chauvin's actions were the only cause of Mr. Floyd's death. The legal standard is a substantial contributing factor. So as long as the jury is persuaded beyond a reasonable doubt that what Officer Chauvin did when he restrained Mr. Floyd for 9 minutes plus and didn't allow anybody to help, including a first responder who was begging the cops, please at least let me take his pulse. And Officer Chauvin literally took out a can of mace and pointed it at that firefighter and said, get back. So the medical experts will suggest that based on the drugs in Mr. Floyd's system, that would not have been enough to cause an OD. And they'll say the way that Mr. Floyd was acting before he flatlined is what we learned from the paramedics and testimony yesterday. But during that time on the videotape where he goes limp and silent, before that, we hear him pleading for the officer to take his knee away, that Mr. Floyd says, I can't breathe, over 20 times. He calls out for his mother. He says, tell my kids I love them. It's heartbreaking. But for the prosecution, it's evidence also that Mr. Floyd was not suffering from an overdose, because what the experts will tell the jury is that if you're ODing from the drugs that were in Mr. Floyd's system, you're not capable of having that kind of awareness or consciousness directly before your death. So even that tragic testimony from the dying Mr. Floyd is more evidence that he did not die of a drug overdose.
And Paul, you spoke earlier about those last 2 minutes. Tell me about why those last 2 minutes are so crucial.
Diane, you and I have talked about so many cases of police violence against people of color, especially. And in cases in which there's been a death, the defense is always that the use of force was reasonable. And the argument is made because that's what the law requires. And in fact, the law in these cases favors the police officer because it says that the jury should consider the case from the perspective of the police officer. And sometimes jurors will go even beyond that and they'll say, well, even if the police officer is technically guilty, I'm going to vote not guilty because it's hard being a police officer. And I think this person was just trying to do his or her job, and we shouldn't punish them for making a mistake. So the prosecutors know that's often how jurors think about these cases. And so they really have to have a strong case that this cop crossed the line. And in the 9 minute and 26 second encounter between Chauvin and Floyd, there comes a point where Mr. Floyd does go limp and silent. And at that point, to state the obvious, he is not resisting arrest. He has not been resisting arrest before, other than by pleading with the officer. But I don't know how the defense can overcome a claim that when a person has no pulse, that he can be a threat. And that's what the jury would have to believe in order not to convict Mr. Chauvin. And again, I think this is a jury that, based on the selection process, will be fair and objective. And I think the fair and objective determination is that The force that was used by this officer was excessive. And yesterday we heard testimony from Mr. Chauvin's supervisor that supports that point of view. And one of the things that that supervisor testified is that police are instructed that if you have someone who you're restraining by making them lie on the ground, that once they have handcuffs on, you have to turn them on their side. There's actually a technical term that I learned in court yesterday, positional asphyxia, which means that anybody who's on their stomach or on their back on the ground is in a precarious situation, especially if they're handcuffed. And what police are trained to do is, again, to put them on their side. And we didn't see the officer do that. And that not only violates regulations, again, the reason cops don't do that is because it creates a risk of serious injury or death, which, again, I'm a lawyer, not a doctor, but it certainly seems to me to make sense to think of that as a substantial factor in Mr. Floyd's death.
Who took Mr. Floyd's pulse in those last 2 minutes?
It's unclear. What we see in the video is, I should say here, the person who we now know is this brave young woman, a firefighter trained in EMT, pleading for the cops to let her intervene. And they say no. She's yelling, take his pulse, take his pulse. And we hear somebody say to Officer Chauvin, there's no pulse, 7 minutes in. And I don't know if that testimony is going to be something that the jury hears from the person who told it. I suspect it's another one of the police officers who's on the scene. And three of those officers have also been charged. And they have a trial coming up in August. They're charged with aiding and abetting Mr. Chauvin. So I suspect it was one of those officers, but I don't think that's been stated in court.
So you have watched police officers acquitted time and time again for fatally shooting black men and women. Do you have faith that somehow this time is going to be different?
Faith is a big word that I think might overstate the hope that I have for this case with this jury. And I have that hope, which I would also describe as a cautious optimism, that this verdict will be based on the evidence in the case, based on the overwhelming evidence that has been presented thus far, based on the careful selection process with this jury, based on very recent history. And by that, I'm thinking of two things. First, that a jury in Chicago convicted an officer of murder in a high-profile case a couple of years ago involving a young victim named Laquan McDonald, who cops shot 16 times. One officer fired 16 bullets. And a Chicago jury convicted that officer of murder. The other historical development I'm thinking of that also gives me a cautious optimism, Diane, is ironically inspired by Mr. Floyd's death and this national reckoning on race that the New York Times reported created protests over this past summer that were the largest social justice movement in the history of our country. There was one day, June 6, 2020, where there were protests inspired by Mr. Floyd's death, in 550 different cities. Somewhere between 5 and 10% of Americans participated in a protest. There's never been a social justice movement that's had that reach. And the reason that gives me hope is in the jury selection process, I think everybody was expecting that the Black jurors would, when questioned, express concerns about policing and concerns about the criminal legal process and whether there's truly equal justice and equal protection for all. And sure enough, a lot of African-American jurors expressed those concerns, and the judge, to his credit, did not exclude them from the jury because they have legitimate and appropriate questions about whether our criminal legal process and our police treat everybody the same. So some of those people with those concerns are on the jury, but guess what? There were a lot of non-Black people, including a lot of white folks, who expressed the same concerns about whether the police treat people of color the same way that they treat white folks. There was one white woman who she had to say on a scale 1 to 5, 1 is strongly disagree, 5 is strongly agree, the police treat Black people the same way that they treat white people. She strongly disagreed, and she's on the jury. And this case is not about that national reckoning on race. It's a murder trial. And the government's got to prove Chauvin's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And I believe in the jury system. I believe if one juror has reasonable doubt, that she should vote to acquit Mr. Chauvin. But I believe in the jury system as a group of 12 people from the community who hear evidence that's hard to listen to and then have to make an objective decision. And based on the ways that this whole country has been educated about the criminal legal process by the movement on Black Lives, I think that this is a different time, and that every American has a more complete understanding of policing and policing in communities of color, including the folks in this jury of all colors. And that's what gives me cautious hope that this verdict will be based on the evidence presented in court and nothing else.
I want to read you something from this morning's Washington Post by Radley Bolko on the op-ed page. The headline is, "Don't Read Too Much Into the Outcome of Derek Chauvin's Trial." He says here, "A single conviction won't stop bad cops from continuing to abuse their power with immunity. It won't stop police from disproportionately stopping, searching, and subjecting Black people to force. It won't reduce fatal police shootings, and it won't give poor people better access to justice. A guilty verdict might deter police from using the tactic Chauvin used on Floyd, at least for a while, but it's unlikely to deter other instances of excessive force or abusive behavior." What do you make of that? How will this trial affect our country or our justice system or the police?
I mainly agree with that excerpt that you read from Randy Balco. And I think that if you look at efforts to reform policing, there's a bill pending in Congress called the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act that's been passed by the House and now is being considered by the Senate that includes a bunch of common sense reforms like banning chokeholds, banning the kind of no-knock warrant that resulted in the death of Breonna Taylor, establishing a national database of bad apple cops so they don't get to go from one police department to another, requiring officers to be trained on racial justice and the history of our country, a history that includes people of color. And this George Floyd Justice and Policing Act would also require that police not be able to kill you unless that's the only way that they can resolve the situation. That if they're able to de-escalate without shooting you, that's what they should do. It's common sense, Diane, but it's not the law right now. I think that all of those reforms would have more of an impact on policing than conviction of a single police officer. At the same time, especially in our justice system, there is something important and expressive about a trial and a verdict. We saw that in the O.J. Simpson case. We learned something from the verdict in the case in which the police officers who beat up Rodney King were acquitted. We often in this country use trials as metaphors, not just about the innocence or guilt of one person, but in a sense, a collective innocence or guilt. Where are we as a nation, as a people, on the issues that are raised in the trial? And whatever the verdict is, in the case of Minnesota versus Derek Chauvin, I think that it will also reveal something, not just about Mr. Chauvin, but about this country.
Paul Butler, thank you so much for being with us.
Always a pleasure, my friend.
That was Paul Butler. He is Albert Brick Professor in Law at Georgetown University Law Center, MSNBC legal analyst, and author of Chokehold, Policing Black Men. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've written in to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Thanks for listening, all. And a happy Easter to you. I'm Diane Rehm.